We are studying in Nehemiah in chapter 1. I think we do need a hookup here, don't we? Sorry. All right. So we're studying here in Nehemiah chapter 1. Last week, Brother Brett Johnson was with us and took the class time, so it's been a couple of weeks ago that we were studying here, and we read to the end of the chapter. We got to look extensively at the first few verses of chapter 1, where he told us about who Nehemiah is and identifies him as the son of Hakaliah, though we really don't have much more as far as his the background of his family, but we do know that he was one of the servants in the court of King Artaxerxes. In fact, the very last verse 11 of chapter 1 ends with the statement, "For I was the king's cupbearer," and so that's why he was in Shushan the palace, as it tells us in verse 1 of the book. So he was there. He was part of the king's court. He was the cupbearer for King Artaxerxes. When you look at the list of Persian rulers, as is the case with a lot of these kingdoms or dynasties, there's certain names that come up over time more than once. Well, just like in England now, there's a King Charles, I think he's the third, isn't it? But it's not unusual that there were in a dynasty where there will be some names that come up more than once. We've seen that also with the kingdoms of Israel and Judah, where some names, well, particularly there'd be some names in where you would see them in each kingdom. But there were two Jeroboams in the northern kingdom of Israel that reigned. And so that's also the case with the Persian rulers in their history. There was more than one Artaxerxes, which is the ruler that we read about here in the book of Nehemiah. And he's the one that Nehemiah served as his cupbearer. And so his name is going to come up in verse 1 of chapter 2, in that it's in his 20th year. Well, this would correspond to the one known in, to history as Artaxerxes the First, who was the son and the successor to Xerxes the Great, also known as Ahasuerus. So he's the one that we get to study about in the next book, Lord willing, in the book of Esther, but this would be his son. So in actuality, when we are reading here in Nehemiah, chronologically, we are actually past the time of Esther and the events that occur in that book. The book of Ezra had the first half was in the reign of Cyrus the Great, the first ruler of the Persian Empire, having conquered Babylon. So it begins with his reign, but it ended the last four chapters of the book, chapter 7 through 10 of the book of Ezra, when it was talking about Ezra himself, who was not with Zerubbabel and Joshua and the first captives that went back from Babylon to the land of Israel and rebuilt the temple, which is what the first six chapters of Ezra is about, under Cyrus. Well, it was later that Ezra went back with another wave of Israelites who had remained in Babylon after that time. And in fact, we're told in Ezra chapter 7, when we learn about Ezra himself, it tells us that it was in the reign of Artaxerxes that Ezra, as he's introduced in that very same verse, and tells us about what he was doing. But then he went to Israel in Ezra chapter 7 and verse 7 in the seventh year of Artaxerxes the king. Well, Nehemiah is going to go to Israel in the 20th year of this Artaxerxes the king. So this is Artaxerxes the first. It's interesting because we do have a, there are quite a few records that have survived from all the way from the time of the Babylonians and Persians. There's actually a lot of historical records. And of course, what we read in the Bible, and we don't believe the Bible because we have historical evidence from whether it's archaeology or whatever the records are. We don't believe the Bible is true because we have this other evidence that fits with what the Bible says. So we don't begin with our faith being in archaeology or those things and then say, okay, well, I accept the Bible because it agrees with this. That's backwards. We have God's proof that this is His Word. God gave His testimony through the miracles that were done by the ones He inspired with these words and the foretelling of future events that God brought to pass. So we've been given those reasons as the proof, things only God can do, miracles and being able to say what's going to happen in the future and make that happen with 100% accuracy. So there's the we have the proof of the Bible being God's inspired word. So it, to us, if that's where our faith is and we have the right reason for believing it, then it should not matter to us at all what any other historical records or what any man might say, because a lot of people will use those things and find a little bit and twist it or turn it and then use that as an attack on our faith. But in actuality, when we look at the evidence that's out there, God has not left Himself without witness with what's remains of those ancient civilizations that we read about in the Scriptures. And so God has provided a lot of evidence to the world for them to recognize that the people that God says lived at certain times, I mean, God's provided a lot of evidence about that in what exists still in the world today. So for us, it's well, I find it very interesting, and when we learn about and see those things, and there's a lot about that with these rulers that we read about in the Bible of Babylon and Persia, and even in the prophecies in Daniel about the in great detail about the Greek rulers, even though it was before it ever happened. And also in such great detail. In fact, that is that presents such a problem, the specific prophecies in Daniel, especially when you get to Daniel 11 and see all of those details that were well in advance by centuries of what was going to happen, these different Greek rulers and what they were going to do. For that reason, there were, for many years, the so-called scholars claimed Daniel had to be written after all those things happened. Even though that was without any evidence, of course. And then what happened I think it was 1948, the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls over in Israel. Well, among those scrolls there was an intact copy of the book of Daniel, and those scrolls go back to centuries B.C., way before those events that were foretold in Daniel. So that shut their mouths because we actually have proof that Daniel's prophecies were there before the events transpired, so that you don't hear that anymore. As far as that claim, it was proven false. But anyway, those are all interesting historical facts. But what God says about these different rulers, they lived. And we've got evidence and records of their time and including their names and a lot of the events that occurred according to their records. And as we would expect, when we have those records there, what God says happened and when it happened, that's exactly right. It did. But we know that from the proof God has given with the his testimony through the miracles and the fulfillment of prophecy. That's where our faith is. So this Artaxerxes that we read about here in Nehemiah, the one that we read about in Ezra, he's the one that Nehemiah is now serving as his cupbearer. But this is his 20th year when these events begin to transpire that we read about in the book of Nehemiah. So this is 13 years after Ezra went to Israel. So Nehemiah is going to go there a few years later. So the temple was rebuilt many years before. Then Ezra goes there and to organize the teaching of God's word to the people that were there in the land of Israel, who are now the descendants of those original returnees from captivity in Babylon. Now Nehemiah is going to go back there to do another great work. So the book of Ezra contained two very major works, the rebuilding of the temple and the structuring of the teaching of God's law to the people back in Israel. Now we're going to have the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem led by Nehemiah. So as we read in chapter 1, when Nehemiah, after he's introduced, there are one of his brothers and certain men of Judah came and gave a report. They had obviously visited Jerusalem in the land of Israel, and they are bringing an eyewitness report to Nehemiah back in Persia. And they informed him of the vulnerability of the city because of the walls being broken down. And we went back and even looked at some of those passages back in 2 Kings chapter 25 where it tells us what happened when the Babylonians conquered Jerusalem. What did they do with the walls of the city? I mean, they broke them down. I mean, after the city fell in the siege, they ended up destroying the walls, destroyed the temple, the houses there. So Jerusalem was made heaps, just like God had said through his prophets that he would do to the city, including the temple, if they did not repent of their wickedness, and they didn't. So God fulfilled that those prophecies and brought that judgment on Jerusalem. So the Babylonians, going back to Nebuchadnezzar's time, destroyed the walls of Jerusalem, but they have not been rebuilt in all of that time. And so the city is very vulnerable to their enemies that lived around them. So Nehemiah received that report, so he wept, it says in Nehemiah chapter 1 and verse 4, and he mourned for certain days and fasted and prayed to God. And so the rest of Nehemiah 1 from verses 5 through 11 that we read last time, but we didn't go through all of it that was there. So since it's been 2 weeks, let's read those verses again to refresh. Nehemiah 1, 5 through 11. In his prayer, he said, I beseech thee, O Lord God of heaven, the great and terrible God that keepeth covenant and mercy for them that love him and observe his commandments. Let thine ear now be attentive and thine eyes open, that thou mayest hear the prayer of thy servant, which I pray before thee now day and night for the children of Israel, thy servants, and confess the sins of the children of Israel, which we have sinned against thee. Both I and my father's house have sinned. We have dealt very corruptly against thee, and have not kept the commandments, nor the statutes, nor the judgments, which thou commandest thy servant Moses. Remember, I beseech thee, the word thou had that thou commandest thy servant Moses, saying, if you transgress, I will scatter you abroad among the nations. But if you turn unto me and keep my commandments and do them, though there were of you cast out into the uttermost part of the heaven, yet will I gather them from thence and will bring them unto the place that I have chosen to set my name there. Now these are thy servants and thy people, whom thou hast redeemed by thy great power and by thy strong hand. O Lord, I beseech thee, let now thine ear be attentive to the prayer of thy servant and to the prayer of thy servants who desire to fear thy name and prosper, I pray thee, thy servant this day, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man, for I was the king's cupbearer. Nehemiah in this prayer is making it very similar to what we saw with Ezra's prayer back in Ezra chapter 9 when he prayed. There was an acknowledgement of the sins of the people and what had led to the problem that they now have. I mean, what's the root of this problem they have? What is the problem? The problem is the walls of Jerusalem are in heaps. There are no standing walls there around to protect the city. Well, why do they have that problem? Because the walls that were there before got destroyed by the Babylonians. And why did that happen? Because of the sins of the people. They had rebelled against God and they had not kept his commandments. Going back to when God gave the law, and he mentions this in his prayer, what God had spoken through his servant Moses. The book of Deuteronomy, and also in Leviticus, but both of those books in particular contain detailed prophecies, promises. When God makes a promise, in a sense, that's also a prophecy about what's going to happen in the future, isn't it? When he says, okay, if you do this, I'll do this. If you do that, I'll do that. That's a promise of God. It's also foretelling what's going to occur based on what they do, right? So that was the case with the children of Israel. God said if they kept his commandments, he promised many blessings upon them. But he also promised many curses upon them if they did not keep his commandments. And among those curses, that's why in Deuteronomy 28, it's such a long chapter because of all the details that are in that chapter about what was going to happen to them if they rebelled against the Lord, which is what happened. They did. And it includes details of God promising that he would bring a siege upon the city where he chose for his name to be, how they would have siege, they would have famine, and then they would be conquered by their enemies and scattered abroad in among other nations. And also as part of that, he said if they repented when that all of that happened, and if they turned back to the Lord, then the Lord would restore them to the land. Well, now, after God said all that back in the time of Moses, here we are over 1,000 years later, and what's happened over that time? I mean, it actually happened more than once, at least as far as Israel being defeated by their enemies and serving their enemies, as far as Jerusalem being besieged and being destroyed and God's temple being destroyed. The tabernacle at Shiloh was destroyed by the Philistines. They made an invasion of the land, and that goes back to the days of Eli because of his wicked sons Hophni and Phinehas. But we read about 1 Samuel 4 about what happened in Israel during those days. I mean, that was before that was at the very end of the period of the judges. But the book of Judges gives that description of those cycles where they would serve the Lord under the leadership of one of their judges. They were righteous. And then after that generation passed on, their children would rebel against the Lord. Then they would be delivered into the hands of their enemies and be oppressed until eventually they would cry to the Lord and repent, and then he would raise up another judge to deliver them, and then they would serve the Lord during that time. And so there was a cycle that we read about that occurred many different times throughout that 450-year period of the judges. Well, then under the kings, we know we've studied all about that too, and there were very few righteous kings, and so there's been much in their history of having to deal with the consequences of their sins at the hands of their enemies that God then sent against them. Well, it reached a low point where he eventually destroyed the northern kingdom, and they were conquered by the Assyrians. And then the southern kingdom, over 100 years later, was conquered by Babylon. And Jerusalem was destroyed. The people were, only a remnant survived and were sent to Babylon into captivity. But there, that remnant repented, and the Lord, after 70 years, brought them back. And that's what we read about in the book of Ezra. So all those things are mentioned by Nehemiah in his prayers, in his prayer here in chapter 1, where he was acknowledging the sins of the people of Israel and what led to this situation that they are dealing with. So they're still dealing with consequences of all those iniquities that they had committed those many years ago. And they had dealt very corruptly against God. Were any of the families of Israel exempt from that? And the answer is no. In verse 6, I mean, Nehemiah even acknowledges his own father's house and that they had sinned against the Lord too. I mean, all of the ones that survived that remnant, Were they doing righteously at the time they were delivered into captivity in Babylon, or were they doing wickedly? I mean, which family in Israel that existed at this time in Nehemiah, whichever ones were still left, which of them could say, well, no, we can. There's a trace. We can trace the record of my family with an unbroken string by generations of righteousness, and no one at any time rebelled against the Lord in my family through all that time. I mean, could any of them say that? No. So there's an acknowledgement of that by Nehemiah. I mean, they had all been involved as a nation, and all of their families had been in rebellion against God. And so they were bearing the consequences of that, or had with the captivity in Babylon and the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. But then also he's mentioning what God had promised, how he would, after they, first of all in verse 8, that God would scatter them among the nations. But then verse 9, if they turned back to him, then God would bring them out of captivity and restore them to their land, and God had done that. So all those, he's summarizing all that had happened with that. Yet there still is this problem, this leftover problem that they have with the walls being broken down. He doesn't specifically mention the walls, but that is the that is what is behind this prayer and the motivation for Nehemiah to be beseeching the Lord here. And what is he asking the Lord in verse 11? What is his request? Well, the request in verse 11, he says, is for God to grant Nehemiah mercy in the sight of this man. That's the request. He's asking God to give him mercy in the sight of this man. Who is this man? This is the king, Artaxerxes, and that's why he says, "For I was the king's cupbearer." So this is the king. Well, this not just any king. This is the mightiest king. I mean, during this time, and this would be as we noted before. This is sometime in the middle of the 5th century BC, in the 400s, that we're reading about, where these events happened in this book. Well, during that time, in the middle of the 5th century BC, who were the mightiest kings in the world at that time? It was the Persian rulers. Here Nehemiah is the cupbearer for the most powerful man in the world. And if this problem is going to be solved, what is the problem again? The walls being broken down. If those walls are going to be rebuilt, are they going to be rebuilt without the authorization of the Persian government, i.e. King Artaxerxes? Is this problem going to be able to be fixed without the king consenting to it and granting by his authority that the walls of Jerusalem could be rebuilt? Well, what did we study with the rebuilding of the temple? How much of that work for the captives to leave Babylon and go back to the land of Israel? Did that require any action by the Persian government, by the king? That was Cyrus's decree at the very beginning of the book of Ezra for them to go back there. They couldn't have left Babylon. They couldn't have gone back to Israel and settled there in their land again without the king of Persia, Cyrus in that case, authorizing that. He made a decree for them to go back there and to rebuild the temple. Well, having been in Babylon in captivity for 70 years, had they saved up a large fund over that time that was going to cover the cost of their journey, moving all of their families, and then rebuilding the temple? There wasn't some huge endowment for a temple fund that they could tap into at that time and do all that themselves. So how was that going to be done? Well, as we know from Cyrus's decree, he authorized them to go back there, also for financial support to be given, the financing by the Persian government for that work to be done. Well, we also know how their neighbors then gummed up the works after Cyrus was gone, and they started making accusations against the Jews to his successors, and at a certain point they had did not have familiarity with Cyrus's decree, and so that successfully stopped the work of rebuilding the temple for a time until Darius, who was also one of those ones that's known in history as the Great. There were a few of them that were called that, but anyway, of course it's God that is great, because he's the one that gave them their positions, but Darius was the one that had the search to be made, found Cyrus's decree, and then issued a decree that Cyrus's decree be honored, and also provided further assistance for that work on the temple to be completed. So he added some things to that. So we know that the Persian government was very much involved in that. And when Ezra, under the same King Artaxerxes, as we saw 13 years before these events here that we're reading about now with Nehemiah, for Ezra to go back to the land with those others, to go back to Israel with quite a company of his fellow Jews, were they going to be able to do that without the authority of the king? Technically, as was the case with the rebuilding of the temple, Cyrus's decree should have covered that, but Artaxerxes authorized Ezra to go back and the people with him, so otherwise, as with the rebuilding of the temple, there could have been some problems because of, over time, the rulers have changed. But for Artaxerxes to issue a decree to authorize Ezra and the people that were doing what they did, I mean, that made that go very smoothly. Well, for the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem, is that going to happen without Artaxerxes' involvement here? It can't. Well, who's going to be the one that's going to have to speak to the emperor of Persia to try to get his permission to have the walls of Jerusalem rebuilt. Well, this is going to be who's the one that God has in this position at this time that's going to then fall to him to make the request. Nehemiah. So this is going to be Nehemiah's job, God-given job, to ask Artaxerxes for the permission to rebuild the walls of the city. Now, could Nehemiah in fear have decided, well, he was just not going to take the risk and ask of such a thing? Could the Lord have found somebody else? I mean, this is much the point that was with Esther that we read about there. And Mordecai, as he was speaking to his niece about the danger the Jews were in, as there was a Haman had gotten a permission from Ahasuerus the king for the Jews to be annihilated on a certain day throughout the kingdom of Persia. So the all of the Jewish people were under threat of destruction. Well, now Esther's the queen. And, I mean, who gave her that position at that time? And that was a point that Mordecai made to her. I mean, why would God given her that position at that particular time? And he used her for that good and completely reversed that situation. And the Jews were saved. And Haman was destroyed. But Nehemiah was given this position as the cupbearer to the king by whom? God. Well, would this be part of why God had... I mean, why is there a Jew in this position in the Persian court? God has a reason for it. Just like he did for Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, going back to the time of the Babylonians, being in their in the court there, and Daniel persisted in that through the Persian kings in their reigns too. But obviously, God has given Nehemiah this position. This is an opportunity for Nehemiah in that position to use that for good. And if he were to be in fear and not use this opportunity, then who could God have found somebody else some other way, of course. But if God puts us in a position to do good and to help others, and if we choose not to because of fear or any other reason, then God can use somebody else. But are we going to be held responsible for what we do with the opportunities God gives to us to do good to others? And if we don't do that, if we neglect that, will God hold us accountable for that? And he will. So Nehemiah here needs to do this. Now, why would there be any... Why does he need to do all this praying? And why could there even be the potential issue of fear to do this? Yeah. What did this... this is not... we're not accustomed in our time and where we live, even though there are places on this earth right now where this same situation could very much exist, where you have a dictator that rules, and if you cross that one, that ruler, whatever it is, if you cause them to be unhappy, if you have one of these, whether it's a king or whatever form of monarchy or dictatorship it is, if you have an absolute ruler and you do something to displease that ruler just with a word, what can happen? I mean, that can be your life immediately on the spot. I mean, it could come to an end. I mean, they could issue an order if you displeased them. I mean, to make sure that you could never displease them again, because that could be the end of your life right there. So this is a situation where Nehemiah, by asking Artaxerxes for permission to go back and rebuild the walls of the city, if for some reason, if he happened to take that as, well, this man's trying to get me to, here he's an Israelite, and he's wanting their city to have its walls rebuilt. Maybe this is some kind of rebellion he's plotting against my authority in that region. And if he were to perceive him as a rival or a threat in any way to his power, even in some limited way in that part of his empire, I mean, that could happen, couldn't it? Couldn't he take it that way and then decide? I mean, that was the false accusation the Jews were using to try to get the Romans to kill Jesus, wasn't it? To have them to perceive him as committing treason as a rival to Caesar, which was false, but that's what they were trying to use. Well, with them trying to... In fact, that was the accusation the Jews' neighbors made against the Jews when they were trying to rebuild the temple, wasn't it? They went back to their history of rebellion against Babylon and said, look, this... If they are allowed to do this, they're gonna rebel against you too, and that's how they actually succeeded in having the work stopped until Darius found Cyrus's decree and the records. So that could very easily be the situation here, without God giving Nehemiah this mercy in the sight of the king. So before Nehemiah goes in his presence, he's already prayed to God for mercy in the sight of Artaxerxes, because very clearly he's prepared to make this request to the king. He doesn't want to be killed for it, but he doesn't want the request, whether he lives or dies when he makes the request. He wants the request to be granted. And so he's asking God for that mercy so that Artaxerxes will listen to the request and respond favorably to it and authorize the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem, because without that, it's not going to happen. So that's the background. There's the situation that Nehemiah is in there as we begin chapter 2. So it says in verse 1 of Nehemiah chapter 2, and it came to pass in the month Nisan, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes the king, that wine was before him, and I took up the wine and gave it unto the king. Now I had not been before time sad in his presence. Well, going back to what we were just talking about, if he's going in before the king and has a long face and looks sad, well, the king might not feel very good about having somebody in his presence with that kind of a mood or demeanor. How much would it take to cause a ruler like that to turn on somebody? I mean, just that alone could do that. There's a reason this is mentioned. So even the appearance of being sad in his presence could be risky. But was Nehemiah, was he sad right now? He was, for the sake of his brethren there in the land of Israel, for the condition of the walls of the city of Jerusalem. So he hadn't been sad in his presence before, but he is now. So this is the first time that he is going to be before the king with this kind of appearance that he is, that he's sad about something. So in verse 2, says, "Wherefore the king said unto me, Why is thy countenance sad, seeing thou art not sick? This is nothing but sorrow of heart. Then I was very sore afraid." He's noticed. King notices Nehemiah's state of mind. He knows he's not physically ill, so he perceives he's got has sorrow of heart, which is true. So he's accurately perceived this. He's read his face and understands what that there is a reason for this, and it has to be for some sorrow of heart that he has. Was it Nehemiah's intention to be noticed in that way? Does not appear to be the case, because now that he is noticed, he's sore afraid. So it's not a... Are there times where we have to try to, as the saying goes, put on the brave face, or in spite of how we may be feeling that in a certain situation that we're trying our best not to let that fully show? There are reasons for that, but is it always easy to, if something is very heavy on our hearts, is it always easy to appear for that not to be the case, or does that show? Does that show on our face? It can, as we know. But in this situation, that could be a dangerous thing for Nehemiah if the king is, if that affects his own mood and decides, I don't want a sad sack in my court, and then say, that's the end of it for you. So there was a reason for Nehemiah to be afraid. It's just, it's a little difficult for us to relate to something, to fear for our life if we were really sad, and if that showed to somebody that we could immediately die because that mood shows. But that was the reality of this situation Nehemiah was in. And we need to appreciate that was the case, because the stakes couldn't be higher for Nehemiah personally, but then as for the people of Israel, this is also, this is going to be the man that has to say yes to the rebuilding of the walls of the city. Was Nehemiah intending to bring the subject up in some way here? And the answer is yes. That's why he was praying that God would give him mercy before the king. But before he gets the opportunity as he maybe have been looking for it, it comes to a head very quickly, because Artaxerxes can see the sadness that Nehemiah is showing in his face, and knows he has sorrow of heart for some reason. And so now he notes that, and so Nehemiah is going to respond to the king's statement. He's going to have to explain what the reason is. He's not going to lie about it. So in verse 3, after he says, "Then I was very sore afraid," he says, "And said unto the king, Let the king live forever. Why should not my countenance be sad when the city, the place of my father's sepulchres, lieth waste, and the gates thereof are consumed with fire?" So he's letting him know that this is the city of my people is in a very bad state. It's walls and gates. And so that's the reason why he has sorrow of heart. Artaxerxes goes to the bottom line verse 4. "Then said the king unto me, For what dost thou make request?" So if he's sorrowful, and now that's the reason, so he's asking, "What would you like for me to do about this?" All right, well, now he's going to have to make his request plain. He's going to be asking for him for his permission to rebuild those walls that are that are in ruins there in Jerusalem.
It might be worth noting that this, what Nehemiah says here, is quite bold. Initially on the king's request there, and it shows, you know, that we need to have some wisdom and when to be bold and when to, you know, be a little bit more gentle.
Yeah. And I mean, he's not, as it might be said, he's not sugarcoating it in the sense that this is a genuine problem. So he plainly states what the problem is. I mean, he's what's causing him. I mean, he's been outed as far as his mood being having this sorrow of heart, and now he has been asked. So he's really. He has no choice but to plainly answer the king, and he's going to have to make the request. So, but yes, all of this, being in the king's presence and what he's doing and what he's saying here, he is having to be bold. There has to be courage here. It's a risk to his own life, what he's doing. Now, he's asked this question in verse 4, "For what dost thou make request?" Now, we might expect the next thing is for him, verse 5 begins, "And I said unto the king," and he's going to make his request, but there's something stated in between Artaxerxes' question, "For what dost thou make request?" and then in verse 5, Nehemiah's answer to the king where he makes the request. What occurs in between that? Yes, he says, "So I prayed to the God of heaven." Well, that's what Nehemiah did before he answered Artaxerxes and gave answer to the question that he asked concerning his request. So before he makes the request, he's praying to God before he gives the answer. This is very interesting, very instructive, and a great example for us. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 17, if that reference doesn't ring any bells with you, the words certainly do. Three words there, 1 Thessalonians 5, 17, concerning prayer. Pray without ceasing. That's what God tells us to do, to pray without ceasing. Well, why does he say that, and what does that mean? Well, does it mean that we're to engage in one continuous, never-ending prayer? Of course not. So that's not instruction for us on how to lead a prayer in our assembly. What is the meaning there? Pray without ceasing. Whatever the need may be. So, in how many situations in our lives should we be praying to God about it? Well, we have similar teachings in the book of Philippians in chapter 4. In verse 6, Philippians 4, 6, he says, "Be careful for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known unto God." In how many things? In everything. Well, James 1:17 tells us about every good and every perfect gift. Where does it come from? It comes from God. What about things that God has promised? Like Matthew 6:33, we sing that song from that verse. "Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you." What things? In the context of food, drink, and clothes. The necessities of life. So our daily bread. What did Jesus teach in Matthew 6, the same chapter, just a few verses before that? What did he teach us to ask God for? Give us our daily bread. Did Jesus teach us to ask God for the things that God has promised? He did. Well, if we don't, do we really believe God is going to fulfill his promises? That's why, what does James 5 say? If any of you lack wisdom, what does he tell us to do? Ask God. But what does he also say there? Can we have doubt when we ask God for the things that he's promised? No. If we don't believe him, are we going to receive anything of the Lord? No. And what's the condition of receiving? Ask and it will be given you. Knock and it will be opened unto you. Do we have to ask? James 4 verse 3 says, James 4 verse 2 says, you ask not, you receive not because you ask not. If we don't ask God, well, do we believe that God is the provider of everything? If we believe that, then in every situation that we're in, who do we turn to and ask for those things? And if we don't bother to ask, then do we really believe it? So what is one of the ways we can show our faith in God that he does provide everything? We need to ask him, and that's what he tells us to do in everything. And so whatever situation we're in, does that mean we always have did Nehemiah say, hang on, king, and then go off and or fall down on his knees right there, like, give me 5 minutes here, and then pray, and is that what happened? Very obviously not. What are the chances that Artaxerxes even knew that Nehemiah prayed at that moment? It's very, very likely he didn't even know. Did Nehemiah pray silently and quickly before he answered? Is that a good thing to do when we're in a situation and before we give an answer, to ask the Lord's help? He'd already asked God for ahead of time to have mercy in the sight of the king, but now when he's going to give this answer, he's praying again. And obviously asking for God's help there. Proverbs 16:1 says, the preparations in the heart of man and the answer of the tongue is from the Lord. Can the Lord help us to find the right words and give us the favor with whoever we're speaking to? If we're making a request to somebody and something like this, to give us favor with them, that they will grant the request. I mean, God can do all of those things, and he's able to do those things. And so that's a great example that we have there from Nehemiah in that situation. And we're out of time now, so let's go to our Heavenly Father in prayer as we close.